Whales and dolphins are a lot like humans. We'll hear about some of the fascinating findings from beneath the ocean. And a lot of women are involved in the seafood industry. We'll hear about a group trying to highlight their contributions and get more women in higher levels of the industry. I'm Jane Adie. Welcome to the broadcast. They learn from each other. They play. Apparently, they even gossip. Whales and dolphins are a lot more like humans than you might think. Michael Muthukrishna has been studying the similarities. He's an assistant professor of economic psychology at the London School of Economics, but he also researches human evolutionary biology. I spoke with him from London.
So it might seem strange for someone who, you know, at the London School of Economics to be studying whales and dolphins, but part of, I suppose, developing a theory of human behavior is that we need a control group to test our theories. And normally, we use other primates as our controls, especially chimpanzees, since they're our closest relative. But the problem with using, you know, primates and chimps as a control group is that because they're evolutionarily quite similar to us and they're evolutionarily quite related to us, we don't know if the patterns that we see or the commonalities that we see in our species between humans and chimpanzees are there because of these, you know, because of the logic that's laid out by these evolutionary theories, in particular the social brain hypothesis and the cultural brain hypothesis, or simply because the common ancestor between us and chimps happened to have certain features, like, for example, quite tight-knit groups, large brains, the tendency to learn from each other, and so on and so forth. So what was nice about this is that we were able to test these theories in a species that's incredibly evolutionarily alien to us and that live in this strange underwater world that may as well be another planet. And what we found is that, it looks like the theories that we proposed seem to be correct because we're able to find these common patterns in these species that are so different to ourselves.
In the article that I've read about your research, it starts off with a line that life is not so different beneath the ocean when you look at dolphins and whales. So tell me what you found that is so similar.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so there's two things. The astonishing thing is the first, we find these patterns across all whales and dolphins that are replicated in patterns across primates. So, for example, the dolphins and whales that have larger brains also tend to have these very tight-knit social groups and also tend to have these very large behavioral repertoires that they tend to socially learn from each other. And they also display these highly social behaviors that are very human-like. So what are some of those behaviors? Well, for example, dolphins and whales will cooperate with each other to hunt. They will engage in what's called alloparenting. So effectively, they'll look after children within their group that are not their own. You know, mm-hmm. It's like babysitting or a grandparent looking after them. They use signature whistles, which suggests that they actually have names for each other. And they use these signature whistles when other dolphins aren't present. So, you know, some people have interpreted this as almost like gossip. You know, it's like saying, hey, you know, so-and-so knows where all the food is. Huh? Let's go find where they are. they help each other out in ways that we might not even help each other out. So, you know, for example, it's hard to have sex underwater. And one dolphin male might kind of hold up another female to allow another dolphin to mate with them.
Really?
They cooperate with other species. So dolphins are known to help fishermen, for example. And they also play with completely unrelated species. So bottlenose dolphins are known to play with humpback whales, you know, as much as we might play with a dog or another species. So there are many, many of these things, and what's interesting from the research point of view is that the species that have these features that seem so, you know, human-like are the large brain species with tight-knit social groups. Just as in primates, the species that display these kinds of behaviors are the tight-knit large-brained primates.
Okay. And so you were saying that they learn from each other. So behavior that one exhibits, the other will learn from that.
Yeah, that's the core to this theory. So in particular, the cultural brain hypothesis says that there are kind of two pathways that you can use to grow your brain. One is through kind of individual learning or asocial learning. This is where you try to figure things out on your own. And you can do this, but it's kind of very time intensive, right? Imagine if you had to personally go out and find all the food sources. You personally had to discover how to hunt, right? A much easier thing to do is to just learn it from someone else. You know, it's like being the kid in class who never actually studied by themselves, but just cheated off all the other kids. That's much easier, right? So what we find is that if you're a species that engages in social learning, It allows you to acquire information with a much lower cost because you can allow, for example, all of the animals to go out and explore, and the animals that happen to find the food sources, you can just learn from them. So this allows you to kind of grow your behavioral repertoire. It allows you to grow a range of things that you can do, which then puts a pressure on brains to be able to store and manage this increasing amount of information. So basically, together, humans have been able to construct the world that we live in today, to the point, actually, where not even the smartest among us could recreate that world. And in the same way, these dolphin pods are able to, and whale pods are able to create a behavioral repertoire that is much larger than any one of them could on their own. And the key to this is the capacity to socially learn, the capacity to learn from each other. And for that, you need, you know, some form of communication. You know, it's useful to have these kinds of signature whistles or just basically any kind of language, right? And so, you know, actually, the orca, and you know, since you guys do think about the ocean a lot, I can talk more specific. So the orca are particularly interesting because they display other features that we would predict based on, say, the cultural brain hypothesis with humans. So they have, for example, menopause. Mm-hmm. They have grandmothers, you know, and menopause is an evolutionary mystery, actually. But it kind of makes sense if you think about brains as being primarily for storing and managing information, then if you are a social learning animal, that is, you're paying attention to those with more information, then animals that have lived for a longer time, like grandmothers, are almost like Wikipedias of their time. They're really worth paying attention to. And in fact, there is data that suggests that they help younger male orca in particular survive better. Mm. They also have dialects. So, you know, just as, you know, people in Newfoundland sound a little bit different to, you know, people, say, in Vancouver. Uh-huh. The orca groups actually have dialects that they use within these groups. And they also have basically ethnic foods. So some orca, they're the same species, but some orca will only eat, say, salmon, and other orca will only eat other marine mammals. And there's actually instances where, you know, captured orca are unwilling to eat another ethnicity's food, if you like, another kind of food. So if you're from a group that only eats marine mammals, then the idea of eating salmon is kind of disgusting. And in those cases, actually, the orca only ate the salmon after, A, very sadly, one of its friends died from starvation. And in the second case, when it saw another orca from a salmon-eating group eat the salmon, and so then it knew it was safe to eat. So, I mean, these are astonishing behaviors, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just an insight into what's going on under the water.
What will you do with this research now that you found that they are so much like humans? How does it help you in your research?
Well, you know, I hope that it helps, you know, other researchers, not just ourselves. So from my perspective, what we have now is a much better, or not better, I would say, another control group for humans. So we have, you know, it would be great if we could kind of go to another planet or something and find another intelligent species that has gone down an evolution pathway. And then we could say, you know, this is how intelligent animals evolved. We don't have that, but we have something that's pretty close. We have these kind of evolutionary aliens living in this strange underwater world that can represent a control group to test some of the theories that we have as to why humans are so different, how we constructed this world that we live in and took over the planet. But the other thing that, you know, I think is important is that our research rests on decades of data that have been compiled in excruciatingly difficult circumstances, going out there and kind of following these pods of whales for a very long time to just acquire, you know, do they play with each other? What kind of foods are they eating? Are they engaging these alloparenting? So we were looking at any instances of this, but we're so in debt to the many marine researchers, marine mammal biologists who have gone out and collected this data for us. And what our database that we've put together, and this is the second contribution, that we have this, the largest database on cetaceans that have been put together. What our database shows is that, yes, we have enough data to be able to show and test these evolutionary relationships, but it also shows how much we don't know about so many species under the water.
Right.
And I hope that, you know, we don't accidentally or deliberately destroy any of these species so that we can't find out about them. And B, that, you know, that these other marine mammal researchers get more funding to be able to find out more about many of these animals that we don't know much about. Because, you know, generally speaking, I'd say that cetacean research is less well-funded and maybe, you know, seen as less sexy than human research. But, you know, what we can show is that actually they're absolutely fascinating animals, and they reveal something about ourselves. They tell us something about our own history.
And that was Michael Muthukrishna. His research shows that whales and humans are actually a lot more alike than you might think. We're 3 weeks into our Eye on Iceland series. We've profiled gear types.
So then they start to hold the line here. It goes through the hook cleaner into the hauling unit here. And the line goes down here with the hooks on.
We've explored ideas about auction markets.
The key is to have a competition. To have a honest, open competition is good for the industry.
We've highlighted the incredible amount of fish innovation taking place in Iceland.
We're a biotech company. We're going to change the world with fish skin.
Realistically, what can we implement here? We'll discuss the possibilities and the limitations with two people who know the Iceland model well and have a lot of experience in the industry here. Alberto Wareham of Icewater Seafoods and Bob Verge of the Canadian Centre for Fisheries Innovation will be my guests live in studio on Thursday, November 8th, as we continue to focus our eye on Iceland. We welcome your ideas in advance, too. Email thebroadcast@cbc.ca, tweet @thebroadcastcbc, or call 576-5287, long distance 1-800-561-3474. That's 1-800-561-FISH. Tune in Thursday, November 8th, as we look to the future of our fishery. Most people would probably assume the seafood industry is predominantly men. Not true, says Marie-Christine. She's a French economist who's been working in the seafood industry for 30 years. She's half of the industry is made up of women. They just aren't visible. Christine co-founded the International Association of Women in Seafood to try and focus on women's contributions and get more women in leadership positions. I spoke to her in Paris.
As I mentioned, I've been working in this industry for nearly 30 years. And I have been surrounded by men in all of my different activities in the business. And after quite some time, I started wondering why was it the situation? And I couldn't find good answers or good justification for that. And then I started to talk about this issue to both men and women, and I understood that there was a need to provoke people to think about this situation and ask themselves if this is a correct situation. And and very quickly I understood that it was trying to set up an association that would give us more means and abilities to raise those questions among the public industry and the more private industry.
Okay, so you say that you were interacting largely with men in the industry, but you were aware that there are in fact a lot of women in the seafood industry.
I could see them. I couldn't see them in during meetings. I couldn't see them in decision making places, but of course I could see them. And a few years ago, I offered to the United Nations, the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, to write a report on the position or the role of women in the seafood industry. So for about a year, that was in 2014, I have worked on compiling all the information that exists. And I was surprised to see that there is quite a large literature, academic literature mainly, on this situation. So the facts are known. They have been written somewhere. But amazingly, they never were disseminated to the industry. So me, as a member of the industry, I've been working in it for many, many years. I had never heard, never read anything on this situation. But the facts are there. The dramatic gender imbalance in this industry, and we have the facts, and now we have to do something about those facts.
How many women do you estimate are in the seafood industry globally? Would you say?
There is figures that comes back again and again. I think that was compiled by the World Bank, which says that 48% of all workers in this industry are women. That makes one out of two. It's quite many. But they are dramatically overrepresented in low-skilled, low-paid, and poorly valued positions. And at the other end of the chain, they are underrepresented at high position, at decision-making position. Myself, I did a study last year studying carefully the top position of people in the 100 largest seafood company in the world. And on these 100 companies, only one is run by a woman. It's a Japanese company. And out of the thousands of directors working in those companies, 9% are women. So again, I could find a dramatic imbalance in the position. Even in other primary business industries like the forestry or the building industry, which are very male dominated, I don't think if the figures are that dramatic at the executive or top position. But anyway, I say that the diagnosis is there, and so we have, and this is one of the goals of the association, this is to make those figures visible. As I mentioned, the articles are numerous. There are many researchers working on these issues in the fisheries and in other industry. But we have to make this knowledge, this understanding available to the people who have the power to take decisions, that is, industry leaders, that is, public policy makers, this is public servants, and we have to promote women, certainly, but we have to disseminate the information. And this is what WSI is doing. WSI is the name of the association, Women in the Seafood Industry. And this is what we are working at. This is to make visible not only the figures, but the work and the contribution of women in the industry.
In this province in particular, there are many, many people in Newfoundland and Labrador, women working in the seafood industry. What would you encourage them to do? You'd like for them, I guess, to become members of your organization, to have their voices heard?
Of course, we would love to host the Canadian and Atlantic Canada women and men, because the association is very open to men as well who want to participate to the change. At the moment, we are running a large-scale survey that is available on our website, where within a few questions, I think it's about 20 questions, we ask men and women to tell us their story on this specific subject. We want them to tell us what could be the solution for this gender imbalance. It is not as if it was natural or as if things were just like that. We know that it is a social and a cultural construction, and that some people want this to change. So we are asking people through this survey what is their opinion. So we first invite your listeners, men and women who work in the industry, to fill in the survey, that this will help us to understand their opinion and the way they see solutions.
And that was Marie-Christine. She is the co-founder of the International Association for Women in the Seafood Industry. And their website is wsi-assoc.org. Okay, reminder now of how you can get in touch with us here at the broadcast. You can email us, thebroadcast@cbc.ca, or you can always call 576-5287. Long distance, 1-800-561-3474. That's 1-800-561-FISH. I'm Jane Adie. Thanks for listening. Let's have all hands on deck again next time.